I personally am done believing what we were taught in school. What in the heck is going on in the 1800s and early 1900s? You're having the orphan trains, you're having cities being destroyed by fires or earthquakes, and then you have these world fairs, the visitors are saying, that are popping up out of nowhere. If children were being relocated on a massive scale, if records were incomplete, and if new technologies were emerging, it leads to speculation about how much of what was happening was purely reactive. If there was a period in history where the world was being reset, would it look like burnt cities, the adult population being locked away, children growing in fields, and orphans being shipped to repopulate the world? Hello, and welcome back to the Gubba Homestead Podcast. I'm Gubba, a first-time homesteader following in the footsteps of my homesteading forebears. I talk about everything from homesteading and preparedness to everything in between. Today's episode is diving right into a conspiracy because there are moments in history where if you slow down long enough to really examine what we've been told, the edges start to blur. The orphan trains are one of those moments. On the surface, it's presented as a story of charity, of children being given a better life. But when you strip away the polished narrative, what you're left with is not just a story about helping children, it's a story about scale. We're talking about over 200,000 children being moved across the country with limited records during a time when the entire world seemed to be shifting. And when you start placing that alongside the world fairs, the insane asylums, and entire cities being destroyed and rebuilt, it begins to raise a much bigger question about what was really happening during that time and whether it was as simple as we've been told. Before we dive in, I want to thank the sponsor of my podcast, which is my small skincare business, Arvati. Arvati began with one towel balm I made for my dad when he was suffering from eczema, and now it has grown into something that helps thousands of people looking for cleaner, truly nourishing skincare. If you are wanting to upgrade your skincare routine and get away from harsh conventional products, you can explore my small batch-made towel balms, cleansers, serums, and goat milk soaps at Arvati.com. I will have everything in the show notes for you, including other podcast episodes that I mentioned throughout this episode. So let's dive in. Did you know between 1854 and 1929, over 200,000 children were relocated across the United States? That number alone should make you pause because this wasn't a small program. This wasn't a localized effort. This was systemic, organized, and sustained for decades. Children were gathered from densely populated cities, placed on trains, and sent into rural communities where they were quite literally lined up and chosen. This part is not a theory, that is documented. But what is far less clear is how many of those children were actually orphans. In the way we understand the word today, historical accounts quietly acknowledge that many had parents. So some were taken due to poverty, others due to social pressure, and some simply disappeared into a system that labeled them as needing placement without much resistance from authorities. Again, this is what we are told. This is the quote-unquote historical narrative. But as you see, as we go through this episode and we start lining this up with the other things taking place during this time period, your eyebrows are gonna start to rise. Now, take that entire idea and just sit with that for a moment. Hundreds of thousands of children, many not truly orphaned, being removed from their environments and redistributed across the country with minimal oversight and inconsistent record keeping. Huh. There is no unified tracking system for much of this time either. Follow-ups were sporadic and outcomes were rarely documented in detail. So entire lives essentially vanish from the record after a certain point. So that should be raising some red flags about the true nature of the system, because when something operates at that scale without accountability, it stops looking like a charity and starts looking like infrastructure. What's so interesting too is when you start looking into your family tree, I feel like a lot of people have this in their family trees. I do, at least from one story that's been passed down through the generations, one great grandpa who actually came from another country, got here to America, and then was shipped out on a train to a rural community. That just seems really odd. And when I tried going back on that family tree before him and his wife, you cannot find anything. There is nothing recorded. So when you start to widen your lens, you begin to see that this was not isolated to the United States. Across Europe, there were similar patterns unfolding. So you had workhouses in England that were overflowing with children. So foundling hospitals in France were taking in large numbers of infants. Institutional systems across multiple countries were categorizing, housing, and redistributing children in ways that were often poorly documented. So where are all of these children coming from? There were even programs that sent children from Britain to colonies like Canada and Australia, where they were placed into labor roles under the guise of opportunity. So now you're not looking at one country dealing with an orphan issue. You're looking at multiple regions simultaneously managing large populations of children who were detached from their families or maybe came from somewhere else and then absorbed into new environments. Then there's that detail that most people have never heard because it sounds almost too bizarre to be true. But in the early 1900s, there were documented cases of children being sent through the postal system, literally. And I find that crazy because I could never imagine going to the post office, putting a child in a box and shipping them. I'm pretty sure you'd get in pretty big trouble. But yes, there were documented cases of it. There was even advertisements for this. And shortly after the U.S. Parcel Post Service began in 1913, families took advantage of the system's affordability and reach to send children short distances, labeled and processed like packages. So while this practice eventually became restricted, the fact that it happened at all reveals something deeper about how normalized the movement of children had become. They were being transported through whatever systems were available. So whether that was trains, institutional networks, or even mail routes. And when a society reaches a point where children can be processed in that way, it suggests that something foundational has shifted in how human life is categorized and handled. So now place all of this into the backdrop of the 1800s, a century that was defined in upheaval, destruction, and rapid transformation. You had entire cities being wiped out by massive fires. So you had Chicago in 1871, Boston in 1872, Seattle, Portland, and others followed this similar pattern. Just whole sections of urban life were erased almost overnight. Something a little side tidbit. So you have the San Francisco earthquake in the early 1900s, which I find fascinating. All of these fires I find fascinating. Why are all these cities having major fires in the 1800s and 1900s? And it's not just here, right? It's around the world this is happening. But the San Francisco earthquake, which was so devastating, I ended up getting an old newspaper about the San Francisco earthquake. And guess what it said in there? That the firefighters were using dynamite to stop the fires. Does that make any sense? If you look into this, yes, they will gaslight you and say, oh yeah, you know, you use dynamite to stop the fire. But in my mind, I'm sitting there thinking, if they wanted to get rid of an area, hypothetically, of course, and if a ton of dynamite went off at once, just tons, right? Because you have ginormous buildings built out of stone and brick, and then you have all this dynamite go off. Is that going to feel like an earthquake? I don't know. I imagine if tons and tons and tons of dynamite was going off, it would probably feel like an earthquake. And then when you look at the historical photos of that time of the, you know, quote unquote earthquake, you have people just standing there all nonchalant. It's just another day. And I'm like, wait, there's tons of fires going on. There's earthquakes. Why are people not in a panic? You know, questions that arise for me when I'm diving into all the fires and the historical photos. I promise if you start looking into all of these fires in the 1800s and early 1900s, you will find interesting things. And this is where the world fairs enter the conversation. They add another layer into the orphan trains that feels almost too aligned to ignore. And I have an entire podcast episode that I will link in the show notes for you to dive deeper into this. But throughout the late 1800s and early 1900s, massive world fairs were held across the world. So you have Chicago's World's Columbian Exposition in 1893. That's one of the most famous, but it was far from the only one. You had Paris, St. Louis, San Francisco, and other cities hosted similar events. So these fairs featured sprawling complexes of grand buildings, often designed in classical styles, complete with waterways, electrical systems, and infrastructure that appeared highly advanced for the time. Visitors describe them as entire cities built seemingly out of nowhere. I have a little collection of World Fair books, and what I find so interesting is just the whole narrative behind that. So you have this whole time where you're having the orphan trains, right? You're having cities being destroyed by fires or, you know, earthquakes. And then you have these world fairs, like the visitors are saying, that are popping up out of nowhere. And this is a time when it's horse and buggy, hammer and chisel, and they are building these advanced buildings that resemble this Roman architecture. So you want to tell me we had that then, and then now we have Walmart? Something is not adding up. And here's the part that really raises eyebrows when you look into this. Many of these structures were said to be temporary. Okay, that's what they tell us. They were built quickly for the fair and then torn down or burned afterwards. So entire complexes of intricate buildings gone within a short period of time. That explanation doesn't sit well with me, because when you look at the level of detail, the materials, and the scale, it becomes difficult to understand why such effort would be put into something meant to be so short-lived. Some people will say that these fairs were not showcasing newly built structures, but rather repurposing existing ones. Okay, so think about that. Remnants of something that came before, presented to the public under a new narrative before being removed. So what they are saying is these buildings that seem to be way advanced for the timeline may have already been there. And what's interesting is when you look at the infrastructure, look at all the Capitol buildings in the United States for a loan. Like, I love the Iowa Capitol building. Just go look at it and ask yourself, did they really build this? And I know a lot of people love to say, yes, absolutely. Horse and buggy, this is the marvel of men. And this is what happens when there's no OSHA involved. And if that's the narrative that you want to believe, you are totally within your right to believe that. I'm just saying, when you have these ginormous buildings, and if you look at some of the photos, they're literally in the middle of a field. So you're telling me horse and buggy drug in all of the individual blocks and materials over a field. There wasn't even a road for some of these, and built them. And then why did a lot of these buildings have to be excavated? So they just, you know, put a bunch of ground over the building after they built it. There's things that are just not adding up. But if you think of it as maybe these buildings were here, then they had to host these world fairs and then get rid of the buildings and tell everyone they were just temporary. And then you have these orphan trains. It's all kind of coming together, or at least is raising more questions than it is answering. Another detail that sits quietly in the background of all this, but becomes more unsettling the deeper you look, is the presence of baby incubator exhibits at these same world fairs. In some of my books that I have in my collection of the world fairs, you can see that, yes, they had whole exhibits for baby incubators. That seems kind of odd to me. These were not obscure medical tents hidden away for professionals. They were headline attractions. Entire sections of the fairs were dedicated to rows of glass incubators, each containing a premature infant, with visitors paying admission to walk through, observe, and marvel. Nurses in uniform would tend to the babies in full view of the public, almost like caretakers in a living exhibit. At events like the late 1800s European expositions and early 1900s American fairs, this wasn't treated as something private or clinical. It was something people brought their families to see, something that was written about in the newspapers, something that drew crowds in the same way the grand buildings and the electrical displays and the technological, you know, quote unquote, inventions did. The official explanation centers on, oh, it was innovation. Incubators were new and hospitals at the time were not widely adopting them. The fairs provided a way to demonstrate their effectiveness while also funding the care of the infants through ticket sales. That explanation is, you know, documented, and on its own, some may say that makes sense, but when you place it into the broader environment of the world fairs, it starts to feel out of place. These events were filled with these massive, intricate architecture, advanced engineering displays, and entire cities that seem to appear almost overnight. So they showcased human achievement, power, and progress. And right alongside all of that, you have rows of infants in glass chambers being kept alive by controlled environments, displayed as part of the same narrative of advancements. It raises a question about framing for me, like, why were babies, living, vulnerable humans, presented in the same context as machinery and structural innovation? Why did this become something the public would not only accept, but be fascinated by? Because when people walked through these exhibits, they weren't just learning about medical care. They were witnessing life being sustained artificially outside what would have been considered the natural process at the time. So the incubator itself becomes a symbol, not just of care, but of control. So of the ability to intervene in the earliest stages of life and determine outcome through environment and technology. I mean, this is what we're told, right? So when you connect this with everything else happening during this era, it creates just this strange overlap. So what in the heck is going on in the 1800s and early 1900s? The cities being destroyed, architecture. You have systems moving children across entire regions, systems absorbing adults into insane asylums, and public displays showing that life can be sustained and managed in controlled conditions. Didn't the Epstein files mention cloning facilities? Also, what about the Cabbage Patch dolls? We will get to that shortly. Individually, each of these can be explained by some, you know, historical narrative, but I personally am done believing what we were taught in school. I feel like I learned more from my old books. And for some, this is where the questions start to deepen. If children were being relocated on a massive scale, integrated into new environments that align with whatever structure is being put into place, the orphan trains begin to look a lot less like a random charitable movement and more like a piece of a larger puzzle at the time, a mechanism possibly for redistributing younger populations during a time when the world itself may have been undergoing a significant reset. The role of insane asylums during this same period adds again another layer that cannot be ignored. These institutions expanded rapidly, housing not only just the quote unquote mentally ill, but also the poor, the socially unaccepted, and those who simply did not fit within the evolving norms of society. So women, men, and even children could be put into these insane asylums under vague or subjective criteria. And what I find interesting is when you start looking into the quote unquote construction of these insane asylums, you will find that many of them are, one, these ginormous, beautiful buildings, and two, are often constructed when there's hardly even a population in that area. So you're telling me when the population's like a couple thousand, they're using resources to build ginormous, beautiful buildings to house the crazy people? Like what? That doesn't make any sense. As I dove into the insane asylums, because one, I started being interested by the world fairs and the fires and the earthquakes, and then you get the orphan trains and the Cabbage Patch dolls, all of this, I wound up finding this article about the insane asylums back in the day, and it says, lunatics had their golden age before laws were made, when they wandered forth at large and were revered as saints or as partaking of something holy or divine, but with laws and civilization, their iron age began. So what was that golden age that it talks about the lunatics that were in the insane asylums had before the laws and the civilization came into place? Seriously, go look at the timelines of these insane asylums, of when they were built and the population of where they were built. You're going to be like, what? That? Why are they spending so many resources on this? And just like the U.S. Capitol buildings, of how they are beautiful, these beautiful, magnificent buildings, so are a lot of these insane asylums across the world. And over time, many of these facilities, the insane asylums, were shut down, reformed, empty, often without incomplete records of what happened to the people inside. So if large numbers of adults were absorbed into these systems, removed from society, or otherwise displaced, it raises the question of what happened to their children. The orphan trains could very easily represent the redistribution of those children into new households, effectively severing their ties to whatever came before. And then decades later, you see a cultural phenomenon that feels almost like an echo of all of this. You have the Cabbage Patch Kids, a huge obsession built around the idea of adopting a child, complete with paperwork, identity, and a story that came from a field. So on the surface, this looks harmless. It's just a toy, a marketing concept. But when placed next to the historical reality of children being removed, reassigned, and given new identities, it starts to feel symbolic. Some believe the children originating from fields is not just folklore, but a distorted memory of something older, something that has been reframed over time into something more acceptable, more palatable. There are even ancient texts that add another layer to this idea, and this is where it gets just really interesting or strange. I actually came across this while going down a rabbit hole on the Cabbage Patch Babies, the orphan trains, and it just stopped me in my tracks. So in the book of Jasher, there's a passage that expands on the time when the Israelites were in Egypt in a way that most people have never heard. I personally had never heard this, and I have read the Bible. I'm very familiar with it. Now, quick context so you understand what you're hearing. The book of Jasher is not part of standard biblical canon. The version people read today is generally considered a medieval text, but who's telling us that though? And who gets to decide what is canon? It retells and expands stories from Genesis and Exodus with added details, storytelling, and interpretation. So while it's not considered authoritative scripture in most traditions, it's often looked at as a window into how people later understood and imagined these events. I personally don't believe any major institution telling me what is canon and what is not. I will decide that for myself, and I feel these things are left out because they reveal more than they want us to know. So here's the actual passage from Jasher. It's in chapter 67, and it says, "And the children of Israel went and increased in the land of Egypt. And when the women of the children of Israel went out to bring forth in the field, the Lord sent one of his ministering angels, who washed and rubbed each child. And he brought them two smooth stones, one of which they sucked, and from one they drew milk, and from the other honey. And when the Egyptians came to seek them, the earth swallowed them up. and they were therein until the Egyptians had departed. And afterward, they came out from the earth and grew up like the herb of the field and like the grass of the forest. And when the Egyptians saw this, they went to destroy them, and they plowed them with oxen, but they could not hurt the infants of the children of Israel. So just think about that imagery for a second. Women giving birth in the fields, children being sustained outside of the home, the earth receiving them and hiding them, swallowing them up, and then those children emerging, growing, described like plants, like something sprouting from the ground. Traditionally, this is framed as divine protection. But when you bring all of this together, it creates a picture that is difficult to ignore, in my opinion. You have massive numbers of children being moved across countries and continents. You have insane asylums absorbing and redistributing populations, cities being destroyed and rebuilt with structures that challenge conventional timelines, world fairs showcasing grand architecture that appears and disappears in short periods of time. You have the cultural phenomenon that echo themes of adoption, identity, and origin in ways that feel just strangely familiar. And then you have this biblical text that they don't want to include that describes children sprouting forth in fields almost like Cabbage Patch dolls. All of what I have to say doesn't give you a single clean answer, but it does leave you with a pattern. So is it possible? I mean, it sounds crazy, right? But the more you dive into truth, you realize reality is truly stranger than fiction. I mean, if you looked at anything in the Epstein files from what was coming out, I feel like you could see reality is absolutely insane. So who is to say that maybe babies weren't grown in fields and then taken to the incubators at the world fairs and then shipped off on the orphan trains to go repopulate the world because they had locked away all of the people who remembered the past and destroyed the cities for the evidence? You see the patterns there and the questions that come about. I find it crazy that my generation was like the tail end of remembering these things. Orphans were a common theme in the movies and cartoons. You had the Cabbage Patch dolls, which were super popular. So they're using these toys in Hollywood to kind of just normalize that time period. And all of this leaves you with a pattern. And that pattern raises a question that sits quietly underneath all of it. If there was a period in history where the world was being reset, would it look like burnt cities, the adult population being locked away, children growing in fields, and orphans being shipped to repopulate the world? I don't know. I'm just a conspiracy theorist. You can let me know what you think. And what I would suggest is start collecting old books, start looking at old maps, because you are going to learn a lot more than you ever did in your 12 years of history at school. Another thing that you can do is pull up historical photos of your area and just flip through them. You will notice that the skies are whited out on a majority of all historical photos, and they'll say, oh, that was just photography at the time. Was it really photography at the time? Because there are photos you can find where you can see the buildings are even smudged out. So, you know, they are busy smudging out the sky and they actually went a little too far and smudged out the building. And I would also encourage you to just keep questioning. Don't accept the narrative. Just like we saw with that space moon mission recently, where there was all these inconsistencies. I mean, they took off on April Fool's Day. And if I talk about it online, they literally community note anything I say about it because they don't want me talking about it. Even if I don't make any statements, they still community note me with their opinions. I'm really targeted on that. That just tells you that I am speaking truth and they don't want you to hear it. So keep asking questions, keep looking for old books and old stuff, because once people start waking up to this, they are going to get rid of it. That's what happens when you have a reset. They burn everything down. They don't want you to have any substance of the past or truth, because they want to rewrite the narrative, rewrite the script. If you've ever read 1984, in that book, the main character, his job is to get rid of old bits of history, and he's also erasing words, because once you start erasing words from the vocabulary, it becomes difficult for people to communicate. That's also a great book if you want to have an insight of where we're at. And I find it funny, they assign that as reading in high school, the book 1984, and everyone's like, oh, we don't live in 1984. We live in something worse than 1984. But once you see it and you start putting the pieces together, it's actually quite interesting. I find it fascinating. The orphan trains, the world fairs, those are my kind of conspiracy theories and why I spent time speaking about them with you today. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you so much for hanging out with me and listening, and I will see you next time.